Hi, I'm Andrea Loyan, Vermont Edition producer, and I just wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening, and enjoy!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. When you think about this year's historic flooding, or the fires in Canada that sent smoke into our region, or the scorching temperatures around the globe, what do you feel? Does your chest get tight? Do you feel like you want to turn off the radio or slam your computer shut and not think about it anymore? Well, today on the show, we're going to lean into that feeling a little bit and work our way through it together. Our guide is Bill McKibben. He has been clear-eyed about the climate crisis for longer than most of us. He joined Vermont Edition in September, and we're re-airing that conversation today. Bill McKibben's 1989 book, The End of Nature, is considered the first book on global warming written for the general public. He's a distinguished scholar for environmental studies at Middlebury College. He and a group of Middlebury students founded the grassroots climate campaign 350.org. His newer organization, Third Act, helps people over the age of 60 get involved in climate action and other advocacy work. He's published a total of 20 books and writes for many publications, including The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books. Our conversation in September touched on the historic flooding that Vermont experienced this summer. Bill spoke with us before attending Climate Week in New York, which was held in September. It also happened to be a week when Vermont Public was holding a pledge drive, and he references that during our conversation. I should note, it was unprompted. Let's give it a listen. Now, Bill, you seem like one of those people who half the time you're holed up at your home in Ripton typing away at an article, and the other half the time you are at a press conference in Denmark or meeting with global leaders. You live a very varied life. What's the most recent event you've attended, and what was it drawing attention to?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm jumping on the train to New York this weekend. Sunday, there's going to be what I think will be the biggest climate change demonstration since the pandemic, a big march in New York on Sunday afternoon. And then at the UN General Assembly, there'll be all kinds of people gathered around New York this next week. They're calling it Climate Week. And there'll be an awful lot of efforts to figure out how to put pressure on diplomatically, legally. And there's people out in the streets today. Friends of mine surrounded Citibank headquarters in New York and locked it down for a couple of hours because Citibank's one of the four biggest funders of the fossil fuel industry on planet Earth. Their business as usual is exactly what's causing us the trouble we're in.
Mm. Well, throughout this hour, I think we can mention some tangible actions that listeners can take if they want to try to combat the climate crisis in their own lives. So let's start with banks, since you just brought that up. What can people do? Is it taking their money out of certain banks and putting it somewhere else?
Well, yes, that helps a little. But Michaela, unless the pay scale at public radio has gone up dramatically, it's possible that Chase or Citi might not even notice if you closed your account.
Well, Bill, as you've noticed, it's a fundraising week here at Vermont Public.
We're all doing our best. look, yes, that's one of the things that people are doing, and it's a good idea. We delivered letters from thousands of Vermonters to the Chase branch up on Church Street last winter, telling people, people pledging to do just that. But we're not under any illusions. As with everything to do with climate change, the things that you can do by yourself are A, important, and B, limited. Yes, you should change bank accounts and support your local credit union or Vermont-based banking. There's lots and lots of good reasons for that, including that they're unlikely to be funding fossil fuel expansion. But you also should be joining together with others in organizations, movements large enough to put actual pressure on the banks, because the goal is not to make yourself feel good. The goal is actually to lower the temperature. That's why Third Act took on such a lead role in this banking action. And Last March, we had a day with 100 demonstrations around the country, including a wonderful one. The Third Act Vermont chapter in Burlington had one of the most colorful demonstrations across the country. I was in Washington, D.C. that day, where we closed down these banks with civil disobedience. We've reached the age where sprawling on the sidewalk in front of the bank for 3 or 4 hours is a less charming proposition than it might once have been. So we found hundreds of rocking chairs. The New York Times the next day had a big story about the rocking chair rebellion that was underway across the country. So that's the key. Find other people to work with.
Well, you've mentioned a couple different forms of advocacy, including laying down in front of a building, chaining yourself to a tree or a bulldozer, sitting in a rocking chair to protest. And I wanted to ask you about a recent protest that I think a lot of folks might have seen at the U.S. Open last week, when a couple of environmental protesters interrupted a semifinal match and delayed the game for about 45 minutes, including a protester who glued his feet to the floor. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on this type of protest and whether you see it effective.
I actually loved what Coco Gauff, who eventually won the Open, said. It was her match that was delayed for an hour. And she said, "Do I wish it hadn't been my match? Yeah. But do I understand why they're there and do I support them? 100%. Because our sport, it's, you know, they've had to like shut down the Australian Open, and you know, it's been gotten so hot and humid that they have to, you know, have intravenous fluids back in the locker room for these guys, on and on and on. It's just one more vivid example of how we're rapidly changing the world. Athletes are kind of, if you think about it, sort of canaries in that coal mine, whether they're the ones who have to go out and now run Olympic marathons at 2 a.m. because it's too hot to do it during the day, or whether they're the ones like our fellow Vermonters who end up trying to ski on, a few feet wide of man-made snow in World Cups around the world because it's not snowing anymore.
Well, you bring up Vermont, so let's focus on what's been going on here this summer. It's obviously been a very difficult summer for many Vermonters with the historic flooding that hit many towns very hard. We've also had wildfires just north of us in Canada that have sent smoke into the region, hotter than normal temps at times. What was your experience like during the flooding? You're in Ripton, correct?
Ripton, someone told me, the eye on the sky would have the actual numbers on this, but someone said that Ripton had actually gotten more rain than any place else in the state this summer. The last I heard, we were at 32 inches. We're high up. We had a landslide that took out a house in town. Route 125 was closed in both directions for days. It's now open one lane up and down the mountain. Thank heaven for the highway crews that worked like heck to even, you know, let us have any way in and out of town. It's been a hard summer here. It's been a harder summer in Ludlow and Montpelier. I was in Montpelier on Saturday walking around, and it was just heartbreaking to sort of the kind of ghost town, instead of on a beautiful summer afternoon, you know. But of course, compared to other places, we've had it easy still. Today, this morning, about an hour ago, officials in Libya said they think the death toll from flooding there over the weekend may be above 20,000 people. They got more rain. They got almost a year's worth of rain in 16 hours. Our dams held, barely, but the big ones held in Vermont. The dams didn't hold on these dry, wadi valleys in Libya, and wall of water came through and took out a city, Derna, on the coast. Whole neighborhoods washed out to sea. There's probably other towns and villages that people haven't even managed to get to yet. So we should, I'm not saying this to make us feel our loss any the less, but to point out that this is a this more than anything humans have ever done demands a kind of solidarity. And of course, the kicker is, if you look at a place like Libya, Africa taken as a whole has put about 2% of all the carbon in the atmosphere, and yet they're suffering consequences on an almost unbelievable scale. So this has to be the summer, I think, Michaela, that rouses us. If it doesn't, then nothing will. We didn't just have a hellish summer. We had a summer that actually was kind of like hell. The temperature, the average temperature for set new records for the hottest day, the hottest week, the hottest month, and the hottest season. Those records go back about 200 years, but the scientists are able by proxies, lake sediments, tree rings, to extend that record much, much farther back in time. They're convinced that we saw the hottest weather this summer that people have seen in 125,000 years, i.e. that anybody that we would think of as a fellow human being has ever seen. And that's truly, truly scary. It's not like we didn't understand that this was coming. I mean, when I wrote The End of Nature in 1989, we basically knew everything we know now about climate change. The scientists gave us a warning and a prediction. We just didn't heed it. We've put more carbon into the atmosphere since 1989 than in all of human history before then. And now we're paying the price. We're not going to be able to stop global warming anymore. Our challenge now is to see if we can stop it before it cuts civilizations off at the knees. And that is not entirely clear that we can do it. And it is completely clear that if we want to give it a try, we have to move much, much faster than we're moving right now.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with the environmentalist Bill McKibben. Bill, what when you were talking about the horrific flooding going on in Libya right now, the staggering death toll there, I noticed in myself that feeling that I get when I start to feel particularly sad or anxious, that tightening in your chest, the feeling of wanting to look away or to shut my ears. Do you get that feeling still?
Yes, I do. I may at some level get it a little less than other people now, because I've had a long time to think about it. I've been working on this for 35 years, my whole life. That doesn't, my whole adult life.
I was like, are you 35, Bill?
That doesn't, I was 28 when I wrote The End of Nature. So it really has been my lifetime's work. And it doesn't make it any easier. In some ways, it makes it more painful because I have a better sense of all the chances that we've missed to head this off. On the other hand, I also have, because I work every day on these questions, write about them, organize around them, I also have a sense of the possibilities still, and of the way that things have opened up in certain ways. We knew 35 years ago that we had to stop burning coal and gas and oil. We just didn't know quite what we'd do instead. Now we live on a planet, thanks to great work by engineers in the last decade, where the cheapest way to generate power is to point a sheet of glass at the sun. That's kind of a, you know, that's sort of Hogwarts scale magic, you know? And if we were smart, we'd be devoting all our efforts to building solar panels and wind turbines and batteries fast enough to start actually reducing the amount of carbon that we're pouring into the atmosphere. We're doing a little of it. The Inflation Reduction Act has got us finally a little bit off the dime here in this country, but we're not, as anyone can tell by looking around them, not doing it with the kind of urgency that what is clearly an emergency requires.
Today on the show, we're listening back to a conversation from September with Bill McKibben. He's an environmentalist, organizer, and writer who lives in Ripton. His newer organization, Third Act, helps people over the age of 60 get involved in climate action. We opened the phone lines during the conversation, and we'll pick it back up here with us taking a call. We have a call from Walter, a fellow Riptonite, Riptonian. Bill, what do you all call yourselves?
Riptonite.
All right. Walter, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm part of a small group, and we've just in the process of starting the Vermont Beaver Association, and our goal is to educate people on how important beavers are to the landscape, especially in light of flooding this past summer. Beavers are really good animals that help mitigating flooding. I've seen news articles about them talking about protecting our wetlands recently, and none of them mentioned beavers and how important they are to help mitigate flooding.
Hmm. Well, Walter, thank you for your call. I also just want to note, Walter, that I am really wanting to do a show on Vermont Edition all about beavers this fall, so I'm going to be reaching back out to you later. Bill, go ahead.
The other person you've got to reach out to is a wonderful writer named Ben Goldfarb. His last book had a good title, Eager, and it was all about the extraordinary role that beavers play in our landscape. And when you get ready to do that show, Michaela, Ripton, one place to start, we've got one of the best beaver dam complexes I know of up off the Forest Service Road past Breadloaf. I haven't hiked in yet to see how it survived this summer's rains, but these guys are usually pretty good engineers, I gotta say.
Mm-hmm. And Bill, in your new essay in the New York Review of Books, Toward a Land of Buses and Bikes, you talk about Ben Goldfarb's book about beavers and discuss the ways that those animals shaped our landscape for the better, whereas the our dependence on automobiles, the roads that we have created that crisscross our state and this country, have changed it perhaps for the worst.
Well, certainly for wildlife, and that's the point of this fellow Goldfarb's new book, which is called Crossings, the one I was reviewing this time out, and it's actually quite an interesting book. And one of the hopeful things in it is that it describes the efforts of people, including some in Vermont, to figure out how to get animals cross the road. I know that there are a bunch of my neighbors, including Warren and Barry King, who go out ritually every spring and help move the salamanders across the roadways down in the valley on the couple of nights a year when that's required. There are a million good things we can be doing to help out this planet. None of them are going to make any difference if we do not get this basic question of the temperature under control. Climate change, the climate crisis, is by far, by orders of magnitude, the biggest thing that human beings have ever done. And sometimes we forget its size. Michaela, every day, the extra heat that we trap near the planet because of the carbon that we put in the atmosphere, that's the heat equivalent every day of about 500,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. When you start thinking of it in those terms, it gets easier to understand how we've melted most of the sea ice in the summer Arctic, how we've raised the level of the oceans. Think about that for a minute. Try to wrap your head around it. How we've changed the hydrological cycle of the planet, which, as you pointed out, we can see this summer. We get more evaporation, more drought, and then we get more fire. Those fires in Canada are going to produce twice as much carbon this year as all the heating, cooking, driving, cooling, everything that people do with fossil fuel in Canada. It's a vicious feedback loop. But once that water's up in the atmosphere, it's going to come down. And it comes down in wet places like this one. We've seen a huge increase over the last four decades in the number of gully washer storms in New England. The easiest people in the world to talk to about climate change are DPW superintendents in Vermont, because they've spent the last 15 years systematically pulling out 12 and 14 inch culverts and sticking in 18 inch culverts because the old book doesn't work anymore. It was written for a planet different than the one we're on. We can adapt to some degree, but there are huge limits to that adaptation. If we don't stop the temperature from rising soon, then we're gonna hit those limits. And even in places that we've sort of thought of as a bit of a refuge, like Vermont. We're going to be pushed past the breaking point. So the time right now is to act. And if you have climate anxiety, which you should, and I do, I'll just say that I've found that by far the best antidote for that climate anxiety is to figure out how to do something, especially in the company of others, to try and make a difference. That's why things like Third Act have grown so fast, and our, the Vermont chapter's just turned into a juggernaut of older Vermonters who are standing up for their legacy.
Hmm. Well, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with environmentalist Bill McKibben of Ripton. He's the founder of Third Act, an organization aimed at getting older Americans involved in addressing the climate crisis and other advocacy work. Let's go back to the phones. We have a call from Jeff in Norwich. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call and my question. Bill, I'm really curious what you think about how we weigh the environmental and the human costs of mining the rare earth minerals needed for the current battery technologies relative to how they're helping us deal with the climate change issue. My understanding is that solid state batteries would be amazing and that might be the holy grail, but we're not there yet. So how do we weigh the complex issues around the current state of battery technology and the costs relative to the climate change benefits?
Jeff, it's a very good question. So in order to make the kind of renewable energy miracle work, we need to do some mining, cobalt, rare earth minerals, lithium. And it's not all going to be, pristine. We should do what we can, and people are hard at work trying to make it as humane and environmentally sound as possible. But there's no easier beautiful way to mine things, as people from one end of Vermont to the other know, because they can look at the quarries that bought this state. That said, the damage that comes from mining for lithium or cobalt or things is minor compared to, relative to, the damage that comes from fossil fuel. And if you think about it for a minute, you'll figure out why. At the moment, we burn enormous amounts of coal to power our lives. You have to go mine that. What do you do once you've mined it? Well, you set it on fire, so you have to go mine some more tomorrow. The virtue of cobalt is you put it in a battery, and there it works for the next 25 years, storing the power of the sun and the wind. Same with lithium or with rare earth minerals. You can get a sense of the scale of this if I tell you that 40% of all the ship traffic on planet Earth, simply carrying coal and oil and gas back and forth around the planet to be burned. A change to renewable energy would be a large step towards dematerializing the planet on which we live. It would also, and this is really important to bear in mind because the numbers are fairly new, but they are striking. It would also, besides short-circuiting the climate crisis with its existential threat, it would also remove one of the biggest threats to human health that there is. 9 million human beings a year die, that's one death in five, from breathing the combustion byproducts of fossil fuel, those particulates that get in your lungs and eventually kill you. We didn't really have those numbers until about 2 years ago, but now that we have them, more are coming in all the time. A new study last week found that the average person in Asia loses 5 years of life because they're breathing those particulates. I don't know if other people have been to Delhi in recent years. It's probably the most polluted city on Earth right now. The average person in Delhi loses 12 years of their life to that air pollution. There's 5 million children in Delhi. Half of them have irreversible lung damage. So if we can move to renewable energy fast, we can save those lives every year, along with ameliorating some of the climate risk. Not only that, just to add one more thing we've understood in the last year or two, depending on fossil fuel means depending on the people who control the small deposits of it around the planet, whether it's the Koch brothers, our biggest oil and gas barons, who used their winnings to deform our democracy, or the king of Saudi Arabia, who cuts off the heads of journalists when he doesn't like what they say, or Vladimir Putin, who took his winnings from the hydrocarbon casino and used them to launch a land war in Europe in the 21st century. The sun and the wind is everywhere, Vermont included, And if we use it, then we've taken away that power as well. So this transition that we could be making right now could be one of the really hopeful epics in our story as humans. The trouble is, we have to make it fast. We're on a timer here. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said recently that if we don't cut emissions in half by 2030, then our chances of meeting the targets we set at those Paris climate talks just 8 years ago are out the window. And by my watch, 2030 is 6 years and 3 months away. So if I sound a little urgent, that's why.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Jeff. I also want to note for our listeners, Bill, we're hearing you loud and clear, but we are connecting to you by Zoom. So there was a moment or two there where our listeners might have heard you cut out for a second and then speed right up. That's our Zoom connection. That's Vermont for you. And you also, I have the
you
benefit.
Also, I think you can hear the crow in the background.
I was just going to say that.
Because I'm out on the porch. So.
I was going to say, I have the benefit of being able to see you right now while our listeners do not, and you are on a lovely screened-in porch with what it sounds like some very rowdy crows. All right, let's go back to the phones. We have a call from John in Vershire. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to continue with the three parts. In terms of mining, it will be substantial mining. In terms of getting all this material, that's A. B is, how long do these technologies last? They need to last a long time. Like the Brooklyn Bridge is very environmental because we use the energy once and we haven't had to use it again. And C, where do these materials that are mined go? Are they plastic? Are they synthetics? Do they pile up? Or are they stone and wood and steel, which go back to the earth? Because if they don't, this is snake oil science and not classical physics. Thank you.
One of the good things about the renewable energy stuff that we're learning is that these rare earth minerals, lithium, cobalt, and things are actually able to be recycled fairly efficiently. I don't know if anybody saw the Apple announcement yesterday of their new Apple watches and iPhones and things. I don't think we need to run out and buy new stuff, but I was happy to note that they're now able to make all those watches with recycled cobalt, which is a good sign. You can't recycle coal. Once you've burned it, it's carbon dioxide, man. And that's the problem. It's the ultimate example of the one-use commodity. So the point is a very good one. Circularity is something to aim for. And look, we're in a lucky position. Human beings have been setting things on fire to power their lives for 700,000 years. Mostly worked for us. You know, we learned to cook food that got us the big brain. We could move north and south to the equator to places like Vermont. The anthropologists think that some of the social bonds that mark our species, the kind of thing that keep us chipping in money for Vermont Public, that those came from standing around the campfire at night. When we learned to control the combustion of coal and gas and oil in the Industrial Revolution, that brought us modernity. But now the disadvantages are enormous. Climate crisis, particulate pollution, fascist autocracies. So the fact that the good Lord was kind enough to hang a large ball of burning gas 93 million miles away, and we now know how to make full use of it, that should be a cause for extraordinary celebration and for rapid, rapid action.
We received an email just now, Bill, that stands out to me. It's a listener named Clover, who writes, I'm listening to Bill McKibben talk about how this past summer has been the hottest in thousands of years. Tens of thousands of people are dead in Libya. Climate change is unstoppable, and so on. As it always does, I also have that feeling of anxiety that Michaela was describing. It's not uncommon for me to start crying and turn off the radio before climate stories end. But I still don't feel like I have tangible, meaningful actions to make a difference. I don't see protests or contacting politicians as making a difference. We bought an electric car and we try to be conscious of energy use, but at the same time want to live, quote unquote, normal lives. And we have limited means to invest in reducing our energy use. Yes, this is a weak argument for convenience over raising three young children off the grid in the woods. I guess if there's a question here, Clover concludes, it's what else can I do that will make a difference besides yelling at protests and in emails? The people in power can't not know that this is a problem, so saying something feels useless.
Well, I mean, saying something's not useless. Our leaders know that we have a problem, but they also are reluctant to move with the speed that they need for fear of offending voters for one reason or another. And so the more that we back them up and tell them they have the space to move, the more they will. Sometimes that requires pushing. Let me give you a good example. The Third Act chapter here in Vermont has been working extremely hard on S-42, the Vermont Fossil Fuel Divestment Bill. Vermont's pensions are still invested in the companies that are the cause of the problem, say Exxon. If you read this morning's Wall Street Journal, there was a big new dump of documents that the Wall Street Journal came up with about Exxon's role in climate denial and delay over the last two decades. And you can tell how bad they were because the CEO of Exxon said, "I know these documents look bad." If the CEO is saying that, then you're pretty clear they're pretty bad.
Yeah.
But we're all part of that, you know. Not only are they bad, is it a bad idea to invest in them, it's a dumb idea. The fossil fuel industry has been the weakest performing part of our economy for the last decade, and it will be so going forward because we're going to make a transition. But, you know, everybody's used to kind of business as usual, including the people who run our investment fund. The new treasurer, Mike Piciak, has been very forward about this and starting to try and get stuff through the legislature. And, you know, Ruth Hardy and Allison Clarkson and others have been working to start making it happen. But we, as I say, we're out of time. So this biennium, this legislative session, I think that Third Act will be working really hard to make sure that it happens, to make sure that Vermont joins New York and Quebec and Maine and a zillion other places that have already taken these steps. Yeah, it's frustrating to have to, Clover's right, to have to write letters and make calls to legislators and governors and whatever else, but that's what it takes because we're not going to get this done one Tesla at a time. We have to be coming together. And if you'll let me just chime in for a moment on sort of in a backwards way on your fund drive, here's what I would say. I wrote a piece earlier this summer called, the title was, "Where should I move?" Because that's the question I might get asked most often from people. And you can make a series of answers about, you know, rainfall levels and exposure to the sea and on and on and on. But in the end, the place you would probably be safest moving is the place where community is the strongest, because that's what we are going to need to make it through. To do the things that we have to do to slow down our use of fossil fuel and to deal with the things that we can no longer prevent, which as this summer demonstrated are large. And that's why I love Vermont. That sense of social solidarity is stronger here than it is in most places I've ever seen. And of course, one part of that is our ways of communicating that knit us together, like Vermont Public. So the story's a complicated one. Climate change isn't a kind of easy, here's a problem and here's a solution. Climate change is so big that it's really more of a kind of lens through which to look at the world, to understand how we have to change. In the last century, the lens through which we looked at the world was mostly about economic growth. If it was going to make the economy bigger, we usually decided to do it. Now, the lens at which we look at the world has to have a lot to do with our survival and our resilience. And to some degree, that has a lot to do with neighborliness, too, in all its facets.
Hmm. Well, Bill, thank you for that message. I should note to our listeners, you're not on our payroll yet. But yeah, I know you've repeatedly trumpeted the importance of local media, and we
at Vermont Public. Thank you for that. We have just a couple moments before we have to take a break, but I want to squeeze in one more call first. Dinah in Corinth. Dinah, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Dinah in Corinth, and I'm a member of Third Act, and I've helped work to pass S-42 in the Senate. What I wanted to ask Bill is, I'm not Vivek Ramaswamy, but how do I talk to people who don't believe that climate is changing and don't believe that it is a crisis? I don't know. Yeah. How do I start that conversation?
And before you jump in here, Bill, I do want to note that we received an email before today's show from a listener named Jay, who wrote, I read and do research incessantly, and I think the whole climate change conversation is bonkers. And Jay went on to list a number of reasons why climate change isn't real. Bill, how do you engage?
Well, so there's sort of two answers to this question. There's people you can't engage with who's just, it's all about ideology. And I tell young people, you know, this time of year, don't wreck Thanksgiving arguing with your crazy uncle about climate change. You know, if you've spent the last 10 years of your life just, you know, mainlining Tucker Carlson or whatever, chances are it's going to be hard to deal with that reality. But do sit down with your sweet aunt, who probably is worried about her grandkids and so on, and try to get her to move a little bit into action. The polling shows 70% of Americans understand we have a real problem and a need to do something about it. Which is actually, for America at this late date, a pretty large number. And the trick is to get a more substantial percentage of that 70% engaged in actual pushing, actual activism, actual writing letters, because we don't need everybody, but we need enough people to make this call unstoppable in our, you know, to overcome that political power that rests in the Exxons of the world and whatever. So, Dinah, so many thanks for doing that. And maybe we'll talk after the break a little bit about the particular ways that older people may have a particular role to play in some of this.
Now, back to our conversation with Bill McKibben, the noted environmentalist, author, and educator who lives in Ripton. He spoke with us in September. His organization, Third Act, helps people over the age of 60 get involved in climate action and other advocacy work. He's published a total of 20 books and writes for many publications, including The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books. We opened the phone lines and heard from many, many listeners during the hour. We'll pick the conversation back up here with a call from James in Bethel.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking the call and for all your great work, Bill. My question is, how do we create more awareness that the U.S. military, with 800 military bases around the world, is the worst emitter of fossil fuels? Because I don't think a lot of people are really tuned into that. And also, how do you square that reality with the future plans that some say are authoritarian by the World Economic Forum to create 15-minute cities to battle climate change?
Well, So to the first one, it's true. I mean, it's actually a really interesting point, and I've written about it, and there's been some good reporting about the ways in which the Pentagon is the single biggest emitter of carbon on the planet. It's also true, and this really helps you understand the crisis, that only adds up to about 1% of all the world's carbon emissions. That's why this is so hard, because they're not coming overwhelmingly from any one particular place. The deepest problem with the American military, I think, is that so often in the last decades, it's been employed to guard the supply of oil coming from the Middle East and elsewhere. That's been perhaps its biggest single use. And so I think the biggest thing that we could do to help change that reality is, as I say, get quickly onto sun and wind, which no one needs to guard. You know, the sun delivers it for free every morning when it rises above the horizon. That's the reason Exxon hates it. That's the dumbest business model in the world from their point of view. That's the reason the rest of us should embrace it. As for 15-minute cities and things, I think what they're referring to are all the urban planners around the world who are trying to make urban life more convenient so that people don't need to be in cars all the time. And I got to say, I've lived in Vermont and the Adirondacks most of my life, but as a young man writing for The New Yorker, I lived in New York and I wrote the talk of the town, so I was out everywhere all the time. And I love public transit, and I love walkable cities, and I love neighborhoods where you can get done the things you need doing. So bring on compact cities with all the services that you could use instead of the kind of things we've built with, you know, a bunch of big around the world big box stores on the edge of town that you have to drive to. I think that's hopeful. And I have to add one thing here, Michaela. I've just been informed in real time that the actual rainfall total for Ripton so far this summer, 35.59 inches from the weather station a couple of hundred yards up the road from me. So it's been one hell of a summer here and across Vermont. We've gotten used, I'm afraid, to the sound of hard rainfall. And that's the part that always gets me anxious, I gotta say.
Yeah.
It doesn't come with, I always used to love thunderstorms, summer thunderstorm, and you could hear the rumble in the distance and there was something exciting about it. Now there's a certain kind of dread that it carries.
Yeah. Well, not to make light of that update, but I appreciate the sound cue. You're turning us into CNN or MSNBC with our breaking news updates. let's go next to Eric and Warren. Eric, sounds like you're a 350.org member.
Yes, long time. And Bill and I have talked at least several times in the past. And we did all the things we thought we should do and tried to set a good example. And it seems that our own kids do almost nothing to follow our example. And it's frustrating. And we know that 350 was we thought was probably the most the planet could handle comfortably. And now we're up to 425. And it's very frustrating, and especially when it comes right down to your own family. So I just wondered if you could, putting my frustrations out on you.
Well, Eric, I'm sorry to jump in there, but I also feel like this, Bill, is a great time for you to talk about some of the work that Third Act is doing when it comes to older generations, setting an example for younger ones.
Absolutely. And less setting an example than following a lead. Mm-hmm. You know, young people have really done an amazing amount of great organizing. I started 350.org with 7 college students here at Middlebury, and we've now organized 20,000 demonstrations in every country on earth except North Korea. This fossil fuel divestment thing that we need Vermont to do, so many places have done it around the world that it's become the biggest corporate campaign in history. We're at $40 trillion in endowments and portfolios that divested. NYU divested yesterday, the latest of $5 billion, the latest big champion of this. Young people brought us the Sunrise Movement and hence the Green New Deal. You all know the name Greta Thunberg, and you should. She's one of my favorite people to work with on the planet. I really adore her. She'd be the first to say, has been to me the first to say, look, there are 10,000 Greta Thunbergs, young people doing this work. But for all their energy and ambition and intelligence and idealism, it's neither fair nor practical to demand that high school students solve the biggest problem that we've ever faced. They don't have the structural power to do it. If you look around for who does have structural power, well, it's people with hairlines like mine. There are 70 million people over the age of 60 in America. We punch way above our weight because we all vote. There's no known way to stop old people from voting. We have most of the country's financial assets, about 70% of them. So if you want to try and push Montpelier or Washington or Wall Street, this is a good group of people to start with. The political scientists are convinced that people become more conservative as they age. And that may have been true at one point, but if you're in your 60s or 70s or 80s now, you're in the generation that in your youth were around in your first act for this period of great epic social, cultural, political transformation, when we started taking women seriously in public life, the apex of the civil rights movement, the first Earth Day. I think that's why the reaction to Third Act has been so intense. In 2 years, we've grown to about 100,000 volunteers around the country. And when I say volunteers, I mean people putting in incredible amounts of time, people in Vermont like Laurel Green or David McColgan, or on and on and on down a very long list, who are really, really figuring out how to make power listen. And so it's been the most fun thing that I've ever done, in part because people are taking it in the right spirit. We had a big demonstration early on against the banks that we were doing in cooperation with a bunch of young people. They said, "We're too young to open bank accounts. Can you come help?" We were like, "Sure." So when we got to the march, Michaela, there were, 100, 200, 300 high school kids out front. They know what's going on. They know what they're staring down the barrel of. And they're also somewhat spryer, so they were at the front of the march. But at the back, there was a big group of us from Third Act with a big banner that said, "Fossils against fossil fuels," you know? So we're determined to play our part. And all I can say is people's grandchildren look at them in a whole new way when they know they're being part of this kind of fight.
Hmm. Well, from older Americans to younger Americans, I want to ask a question from a caller that I don't think we're going to have time for, so I'm just going to sum it up real quick. Molly in Charlotte, hope I do your question justice, but they're asking, what are the best careers to get into to combat climate change? And Bill, we have about a minute left.
If you're a young person, one career worth looking at right now is electrician, because we're going to need a million more of them in this country in order to put up those solar panels, put in the heat pumps, and we need a lot in Vermont right now. And Vermont and other places are starting to mobilize to make that happen, and we'll need to do a lot more of it. There's a thousand, the good thing about climate change is, I guess, it's so big that no matter what it is you're good at, psychology, accounting, on and on and on, you can play a big role in this. But that's going to be the pinch point as we try to make this country and this world work in a new electrified world. People who can wire, people who can do plumbing, HVAC, on and on and on. These are crucial, and they're good jobs, that are going to be around for a long time and that we're going to depend on. So have at it would be my advice. It's really fun to see the number of green builders and contractors and solar engineers and everything else spreading out across Vermont. A great way to spend one's life.
Hmm. Well, Molly, hope that answers your question. Hope to be calling you for all of our electrical needs in the future. And Bill McKibben, noted environmentalist, author, educator, and resident of Ripton, Vermont, thank you so much for your time today. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, Michaela, what a pleasure for me, and I'm off to update my pledge. So many, many thanks for all you guys do every day.